Unreal. Uncensored. Unradio.
CliffCentral.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com, where we talk about all things around the world, news in action around the world and in locally, and everything that the Daily Maverick is covering as an editorial team. I'm Stili Karalambos. I'm joined in studio by Simon Allison, our Chief Africa reporter. And we'll be calling some of our journalists out there in the field today to give us feedback and insights on news that the Daily Maverick is covering. I'd like to start with a couple of news snippets from around the world, Simon, if we can. New York became the 23rd state in America to legalize medical marijuana.
It's a tidal wave, isn't it? This is really a generational shift. By the time our kids are grown up, weed's going to be legal in a lot of countries, I think.
Yeah, we've seen, I mean, this is New York, and medicinal marijuana is very different to the legalization of normal marijuana that was sold out of medicinal purposes and was passed by the states of Colorado and Washington State. I think Washington, Colorado began selling at the beginning of this year, and Washington started selling from today, actually, normal marijuana. And it's been quite interesting to see the effects that and especially in Denver, which is the biggest city in Colorado, the effects that it's had on crime and as well as tax revenue, which is quite interesting and also I think quite surprising to a lot of those conservative naysayers who weren't really expecting for crime to be down in the first 6 months since marijuana went on sale legally in Colorado, and who saw tax revenues up by something like $11 million in the city of Denver.
It's a win-win situation, isn't it? Everyone's happy. You know, it's getting harder and harder to make the case against marijuana. I think ultimately the science is showing, the experience is showing that it's really not a drug that's in the sort of categories of your heroines and your cocaines, which is what people are really worried about. And I think for so long people have confused the two. They think drugs are drugs, and you know, they must all be tarred with the same brush. And now we're realizing that actually, no. I mean, if you think about it, alcohol is probably the most potent drug that we all use on a regular basis. Weed is on a similar level and is beginning to be treated as such. And I think that just makes a lot of sense on so many levels.
I actually wrote a piece called Prohibiting Prohibition about 2 years ago, where I looked into the economic argument against legalizing drugs, actually all drugs, not just marijuana. But obviously the biggest case is for marijuana. Looking at the states and the economic angles of arguing for legalization, the biggest one is that, first of all, it is already, as an illegal activity and an illegal drug, it is already the third biggest crop in America. Okay,
that's incredible.
Now, third biggest. It's third biggest behind wheat and one of the other grains as well. So it's already there. People are already doing it. Now, what the government is missing out on is the tax revenue from that. So, you know, sort of the will of the people have spoken and people are using it anyway. So let's tax it. Let's get that revenue into the system, into the economy, and let's get used, because, you know, there isn't a country out there that couldn't use a boost with tax revenue at the moment. The other one is that something like almost half of all incarcerated prisoners in America are there on the back of some kind of drug-related offense. Now, the cost to keep these guys incarcerated and in prison and fed and, you know, is quite steep and comes at, you know, at the cost of the taxpayers' contributions to the fiscus. So you've got some really big and interesting economic arguments against legalizing not only marijuana, but a lot of the other drugs as well.
And you think for a capitalist society like America, that is ultimately what should carry the day, really.
Yeah, so I think now that New York is the 23rd, we'll probably see a lot more of these states picking up. It's interesting to note, though, that New York don't allow the smoking of medicinal marijuana. They've only allowed the consumption via vaporizing through those, you know, fancy sort of e-cigarettes, oils, and edible forms of medicinal marijuana. So, you know, they think they're, you know, they've gone the clever route, smarter route.
I don't know much about these other forms of doing it. What's the difference? Is there a difference in effect? Do you get less high with one of these methods? Or
I don't think there's a big difference. I think there's probably some kind of socio-psychological factor in that, in that, I know maybe smoking as an act itself is taboo and has been outlawed, and probably anti-smoking laws, as well as the fact that, you know, it might be done under, you know, more civil circumstances. Maybe that's the reason.
I do know someone who's just come back from America, where she went to one of the states where you can buy medical marijuana, and has returned with marijuana suppositories.
Wow.
Which frankly terrifies me.
Well, I guess if the movie Trainspotting was anything to go by, I guess you know there are various ways to take your medicine. Some other interesting news from around the world. We've seen Pope Francis come out and, in one of his strongest statements, come out and apologize for the sexual offenses that the Catholic Church has been responsible for. And this is in line with a zero-tolerance policy that he's certainly picked up the rhetoric and the talking about, and certainly used stronger language than any pope has ever used before. What do you make of this new policy of the pope?
You know, it's not unprecedented. So his predecessor, Pope Benedict, also apologized to victims face-to-face in a similar manner, using not quite as extensive an apology, but he did apologize nonetheless. And it has taken this current pope a good 16 months into his tenure before he's really addressed the issue in a meaningful way. So, yes, I think he has made a start, but I'm not sure that it is he deserves all the praise he's getting at the moment, because what has he done to actually address the problem? Specifically, what I think the church should be looking at is its laws on priests and sex. When you forbid something like sex, when you repress it, when you make it something sinful and illegal in the way that the church has made it for their priests, then I think almost inevitably there are going to be people that rebel against those restrictions, and that rebellion takes a number of ways, and some of them end up in this kind of sexual abuse that we're seeing. There's got to be a reason that Catholic priests in particular have so many issues with sexual abuse, and I can't help but think the theology that underpins their situation is part of the reason.
Yeah, it's the one thing that does stand out from a lot of other clerical rules and belief systems, and maybe even go one step further. I mean, obviously, which is not a sexual abuse issue, but also a feminist issue, is you know, that the Catholic Church still doesn't allow women to be priests, you know, in the clergy. I wonder if that would have any effect on the sort of sexual misconduct of you know, of what the Catholic Church has to deal with at the moment.
Well, you know, an interesting parallel. So I went to university at Rhodes, and a lot of the kids at Rhodes were boys who'd been to these fancy private schools, these boarding schools, you know, your Hiltons and your Michael Houses, that sort of thing, where they hadn't really experienced female contact for their formative years. They'd rock up at university, and they didn't know how to talk to women. They didn't know how to treat women. And almost inevitably, it ended up that they were the ones who were least respectful towards women. They tended to objectify them the most. I guess they're
especially
only
when you put some Holy Communion in as yeah, well.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is if you put men in a situation where they have very little or limited contact with women, after a few years, what happens is you lose the ability to deal with them properly. And I do think that this is also a factor, is you have these men who are physiologically exactly the same as the rest of us, but they are given no outlet for that, and they're not even allowed to, you know, talk to, and it just leads to this really unhealthy situation, I think.
Another bit of news from the Vatican that was out today is that the Vatican Bank, that some people may or may not know that it exists, is going to be abandoning all its investment banking activities. So over the course of the years, I mean, the Catholic Church, which is one of the richest institutions that obviously has been running for centuries, has been accumulating wealth over the years and, you know, engaged in investment banking asset management activities, which has drawn a lot of criticism, not only from, you know, the purists of what a, you know, church is supposed to do, but was drawn into a lot of money laundering scandals throughout the years, and actually resulted in the head of the bank, I think about 10 years ago, committing suicide and hanging himself, you know, with regards to some of the money laundering accusations. So not really covering itself in a lot of, you know, glory, so to speak.
No, absolutely not. I mean, the church has been a money-making institution for all of its existence and phenomenally successful. it has to be one of the most enduring financial institutions in the world. I can't think of anyone else that's been making as much money for as long as the Catholic Church. So that it was involved in investment banking is no surprise. I do wonder if this now rollback, this abandoning of their position, is that because of the negative PR, do you think, or is it because there's a sort of more principled stand being made? I suspect the former.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you on that one. So we've been covering some of news from around the world that you'll get in the Daily Maverick newsletter if you sign up on the Cliff Central website. Go have a look for Join Us and enter your details there, and you'll get some fresh overnight news every morning in your inbox between 6:30 and 7. On the line, we've got our American specialist correspondent, Brooke Spector, who's just returned from Grahamstown and the National Arts Festival. Brooks, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Staley. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Brooks, tell us a little about your trip to Grahamstown.
Well, I mean, Grahamstown has been going as a festival. The city's been going for quite a while, but as a festival, it's on its 40th anniversary this year, which is quite something, given all the changes that have happened in the interim. It started out as a very small event celebrating the dominance of the preservation of the English language, and was actually originally the Shakespeare Festival, which tells you pretty much where they were placing themselves. But over time, especially in the late 80s and early 90s, it became one of the dominant places for the officialization of protest art, protest theater. People showed up, they said their pitch. It was something of an artistic free space where the consequences were you might have influence rather than find a jail cell. And now it's become, as they like to say, the second largest in just sheer numbers of events of any arts festival, cultural festival in the world, and certainly the biggest on the continent. And this year they had participation from something like 40 countries around the world on the various stages. And the thing includes visual art, it includes dance, music of all types, from symphonic through to jazz, through avant-garde experimental stuff, to theater in any manifestation you can think of, even a play which takes place literally inside a parked car in a parking lot, in which the audience clusters around it as night falls, and they get cold, obviously, and they have to stamp their feet and drink coffee. But the play takes place inside the car, and you get works that were magical years and years ago and are being revived, and you get new work, and you get classics from the ages, and then, of course, there are physical theater and performance and site-specific art. And there was even Joey. You know who Joey is, don't you?
No, Brooks, tell us.
Joey is the horse in War Horse, the mechanical artificial horse in the stage play War Horse, done by Basil Jones and Adrian Kohler, who are South Africans. And it's the play that's been running in London and New York for some time, and is coming here in October. But Joey the horse, or at least one version of Joey the horse, is on performance in the middle of the city of Grahamstown on an open field. So there's all kinds of different things. I mean, I went and saw performances by people like Kyle Shepherd, who is the new wonder kid of South African jazz. This year he's one of the Standard Bank Young Artist Award winners. He's under 30, and he is a prodigious talent at the piano. And his music recapitulates all the different influences that went into Cape Town's musical tradition as a jazz tradition. You listen to it, you hear the sounds of the church, but you also hear the muezzin's call from the minaret. You hear American jazz idioms, and you hear some people will say right back to the original people their chants, and he likes to think so, and he really is quite extraordinary. And then I went and I took a look at one of the international groups, the Ballet of Geneva in Switzerland, and they did an extraordinarily interesting retelling of the classic work, Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespeare's play, Put on Dance. And what was, well, let me put it to you this way. There were two interesting features in it, besides the fact that the dancers really were talented and supple and exciting to watch. Stage is basically totally bare. Oberon descends from the heavens on a giant red feather. There's no Puck. I mean, it scares you. Puck is central to the play. There's no Puck except a blow-up balloon version that is wheeled on and off occasionally. And if you had to give it one identifier as a production, let's put it this way, the Ballet of Geneva, Midsummer Night's Dream, was decidedly and profoundly phallocentric.
Brooks, what was the highlight of the arts festival for you?
Besides the exciting and supple dancers.
Yeah, the young nubile dancers.
Those. Especially the young and nubile ones. I think Kyle Shepherd, really. I saw some other jazz, a very good composer and conductor, Maria Schneider from the United States, Grammy Award winner multiple times. But I really fell in love with Kyle Shepherd's work. But the play that I liked the best was something that Sylvain Strike and Atandwa Kani, John Kani's son, you see him on television and on stage. It's a play called Black and Blue, and it takes place in a sort of a metaphorical garden of a house. A woman has just lost her husband through suicide, and her mood is profoundly blue. And Kani shows up and bangs on the door and says, "I am here to be your gardener." And you're left wondering, maybe, has he been sent to do these things? And they, through the various sort of dreams that the two of them have and the illusions, he creates a garden. They engage in this lovely ballroom dancing, which clearly wasn't taking place for real. But it's such a warm, gentle thing. You leave the theater with a smile on your face. There's no other way to describe it. It really made me feel good to watch that. Then I saw a lot of comedy, which wasn't very funny. There's something afoot in this country that makes it hard for comedy as opposed to satire or stand-up comedy work. But we did see one play, Civil Parting. It's about a gay couple that has decided to dissolve their civil union. Civil unions are, you know, marriage by another name, and they're sitting in a lawyer's office. The lawyer is late, and they're engaging in a running snit fight about the collapse of their relationship. And it's perfectly delivered. The writing is good, but the acting is just exciting. And without betraying the end of it, because people may want to see it if it travels further or if it comes, if they even get to Grahamstown, perhaps. There's an absolute snapper of an ending that's delivered in the last 5 or 6 seconds of the play. And you think it's all going one direction, and all of a sudden it heads off in an entirely different way.
Oh, we'll look after that. Brooks, as a barometer of South African art scene, what does the arts festival have? I mean, what does it say about South Africa? Is it in a good place?
It's in an interesting place. There are a lot of good elements and a lot of not-so-good elements. I think the two little straws in the wind... A musical, I swear to you, a musical based on the events of Marikana.
Wow.
Wrap your head around that. Yeah. Put on by, developed and directed by Aubrey Sakabi from the State Theater. It didn't make it in time for me to see it because the festival's still going on. It didn't make it because it had not one but two breakdowns of its bus bringing it there. And that leads cynics to at least think about the possibilities of somebody... Parties unnamed pouring a little sugar in the fuel tank. Mm-hmm. They had to send a third bus to rescue the other two bus drivers plus the cast and the scenery. But the other, I think, disquieting element perhaps was the opening event, which was the new Minister of Arts and Culture, Nadia Ntethwa, previously from another government ministry, mm-hmm. of course. And he started out with a speech which praised diversity and, you know, the goodness and light of the Rainbow Nation and all the rest of this. And apparently in his extemporaneous remarks added on to it, he warned artists not to get involved in things that were destructive and critical and were not aligned to the to the way in which people should respect authority. That, for artists, that's a real red flag right in front of the bull.
That's pretty much exactly what everyone was fearing would come out of Natim Teto's mouth when he was appointed, and the kind of thinking that would come out from the ministry with someone like him in charge who doesn't really have the background or comes from a place where, you know, the police ministry hasn't exactly been basked in, you know, glory and plaudits for what they've been up to in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I've been the Facebook chat on this thing. Somebody said earlier today, well, what does it matter what a minister thinks? Nobody listens to them anyway. And then there was a response, a rejoinder that said, yes, until they do something that causes everyone to sit up and think about what they have just done. And it really is a problem. If people actually think, or if ministers actually think, they are in charge of the artistic and cultural sector, or the artistic and cultural life of the country, you know, not to put it more bluntly, then, you know, there is something afoot. You know, there is the profoundly wrong signal is being sent. Politicians are not in charge of the artistic and cultural life of the country, and artists often stand in opposition to politics as it is practiced, and that's what a lot of artists think their real role in life is, to stand there and say, aha, the emperor doesn't have any new clothes on at all, doesn't have any clothes whatsoever, that what is being done is disturbing, what is being done is wrong, and here's a vision that's a very much an alternative. And then we get into the world of Brett Murray and the Spear and Ayanda Mbalula's painting of Jacob Zuma as well. And the moment you start to put a chill on that kind of thing, then artists and the government stand foursquare in opposition to one another, and that is obviously not the intention of the minister, but that's going to be the effect if that kind of verbal pyrotechnics keeps up.
And even if we think back to the deepest and darkest of apartheid days, how, you know, the performing arts used their outlet to protest what was going on.
Not every artist, obviously, and there were state-supported artists and performers who felt perfectly comfortable in a more constricted space. And, you know, to a certain extent, I mean, to play a Beethoven symphony is very rarely considered a subversive act, unless it's World War II and you play the first couple of notes of the Fifth Symphony. Da-da-da-da, you know, V for victory sound. But so much of what constitutes the creativity in the arts is something that says, something is not right in this garden. Something is wrong about what's going on. Something needs to be pointed out. And the moment you get ministers who don't understand that, or worse, who understand it all too well and want to squelch it, then we're just in dangerous turf.
I was thinking more about the irony of, especially with things like struggle songs in the old days, how the apartheid government was trying to, you know, ban them, come down hard on them, and actually had the reverse. The reverse effect.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the old regime managed to do was to guarantee that more and more people put their embrace around works that were profoundly subversive of the current order. I can remember very specifically back in 1988, it was. And this is deep in the depths, right? There was a production of Othello at the Market Theater. Othello, of course, is that Shakespeare play about Othello, the black man who is a general for the Venetians, and whose wife is Desdemona, who is very clearly white, and there is a fatal triangle with his subordinate, Iago, who betrays them, and the end result is Othello kills his wife. Now, to play that here in the middle of the 1980s on stage with very clearly a black man in the role of Othello, as in John Connie, and to have an embrace and a kiss that is so lusty and so vigorous that you can only imagine what happens, you know, at the end of that act, was to the audiences of the time both exhilarating and astonishing. And we drove all the way over from another country, literally, to see the production. and it was, the room was packed, and you could hear, I swear, you could hear insects breathing in that room. People were so hushed, because this was a slap across the teeth of the conventions of the time. And I mean, this is what artists are good at. And I worry about what the import of a message as delivered by the minister in his, as I hasten to say, in his extemporaneous remarks rather than the prepared ones, is going to mean. And it may well just harden the resistance to listening to what a ministry has to say at all.
Brooks, before we let you go, what was the attendance like at the festival? Was it well supported?
Oh yeah, no, it always draws good crowds, and you see people from four corners of the round earth. I never understood that phrase, four corners of the earth, but it draws a good international showing. It draws lots of people from across the country. I stood in line to get a cup of coffee from somebody who had literally flown back from Trinidad. They're originally South African. They're sailing around the world on a yacht, and they came back to do a family visit, and while they were here, they flew on to the festival as well. So it's getting people from about as far away as you can arrange. There are participants and performers from China, Argentina, and scads, of course, of South Africans. And I was there in the early days, but you could see the buses beginning to come in of students and groups from all over the country. So it's we'll see the eventual figures at the end of the festival on the 13th, and they'll announce the total attendance. And they can get a pretty good guess, because they can measure the number of tickets sold and by and to whom, because it's almost all the tickets are electronicized now.
Brooks Spector, thank you so much for your input on the Grahamstown Arts Festival. We look forward to reading your piece tomorrow on Daily Maverick.
Okay, take care.
Thank you. Simon, I see Mamusi Maimane has written an opinion piece in Daily Maverick today, coming out calling for a referendum to you know, find out the will of the Gauteng people with regards to e-tolls.
Yeah, he's saying that basically the situation has gone so far that we need to determine the will of the people on this. We can't just go along with where we are at the moment, because no one seems to know what's really going on, and that we do live in a democracy, and the best way to test a democratic sentiment is to put it to the vote, and the best way to do that is a referendum. He's also saying that e-tolls have exposed the flaws of the sort of public participation clauses of legislation. So almost all legislation needs to be vetted by the public. So there's always a period where you're allowed to comment, you're allowed to submit your concerns about legislation as a member of the public or as a concerned civil society activist, and that should in theory be taken into account in the final legislation. However, the final legislation is usually the sole preserve of either the government or the parliament, depending on what exactly the legislation is. Now he's saying, look, e-tolls has exposed that this doesn't really work, because what the government did with e-tolls, they put a few ads in the newspapers, they got 82 submissions back.
Out of 12 million residents, exactly. Of Gauteng.
So it's a lot. So he's saying, look, let's put it to the people and let's see what they think. I think this is a terrible idea, frankly. Referendums, you know, there's a reason why we don't have a direct democracy. There is a reason why we don't vote on every single bit of legislation. And that's because inherently, I think, the public is an unreliable barometer of all kinds of things. If you were to put certain provisions of the South African Constitution to the public in a referendum, I'm thinking particularly of the gay rights clauses, they wouldn't pass in this country. Mm-hmm. Surveys have repeatedly showed that public sentiment is not in favor of gay rights. However, it's in our Bill of Rights, it's in something we hold dear as a country, and it's informed all our legislation. So would we willingly give things like that up? I'd like to think not. So you know, you've also seen other countries where going to the polls doesn't necessarily lead to the best result. Like a good example is in Egypt recently, where they had an election, a second election. They had one election, and the Muslim Brotherhood Party won. Then they were deposed in a coup. After about 6 months, they had another election, and the coup leader actually won by something like 90%, which is just crazy. It just shows that people weren't actually going out to vote. So even so-called these direct democracy, where everyone has the right to vote, people don't necessarily vote, and it just means you give more voice to the slightly more active.
So in short, jumping on the populist bandwagon.
Yes, he is. I think the DA would be very weary of taking a lot of their policies to public referendums, because I have a feeling they'd be laughed out of, well, not office, because they're not in office. That's precisely why.
On the line, we've got Rebecca Davis, who's been covering the Oscar Pistorius trial extensively for Daily Maverick. Good afternoon, Rebecca. You there?
I am here. How are you?
All right. Great. Great to hear your voice. Tell us what's happening. What's the latest in the trial? The defense was closing its argument today?
Yes. The defense has officially rested. They have finished their case to keep Oscar Pistorius out of prison. They've done all they can. And now we wait for closing arguments. So there was initially some speculation that they might actually have one more witness up their sleeve today, and yet another psychological witness, or rather someone testifying as to the Pistorius' psychology of disability and vulnerability. But that turned out not to be the case. They've indicated that they were finished. And again, there was some speculation that the state might in fact also reopen their case, particularly to try and counter some of the evidence given by expert witness Wayne Derman last week, but that proved also to be false. So as things stand, both the state and defense have closed their cases. Now we wait until 7th of August, when court will resume with closing arguments. That's, of course, when both sides deliver their final compilation of evidence. They counter the points made by the other side during the case and so forth. And the state will go first, followed by the defense, probably on the 8th.
And what's the expectation after that, after the closing arguments? How long before we get a verdict?
Yeah, it's unclear. Often there can be quite a big gap, as I understand it, between closing arguments and the final judgment, the verdict. In this case, there's some indications that Judge Thokozile Masipa wants to get on with it. We've heard, for instance, that she's started writing her judgment already, and that she has other matters to deal with. So the only question is whether the other matters she has to deal with will delay or expedite the delivery of justice in this case. Because if they are stacking up behind her, she may want to get the matter over with very quickly, or if they're going to intervene, she may have to hold on until she's dealt with those things. Some journalists have been tweeting that we'd like you to see a verdict by the end of August. So that would obviously be pretty sharpish on the heels of the closing arguments. Otherwise, I'd say we were looking at September.
Well, the last thing we want to see is a Christmas tree in the background of the trial, as we I don't think anyone's going to be able to survive that. I wanted to ask you about this leaked video, Rebecca. It caused quite a big stink yesterday. Obviously, they got the defense's feathers or they got their backs up. How do you think it helped their case in any way? Did it hinder their case? Is there any effect on the trial from this leaked video?
No, not currently anyway, and it doesn't seem that there will be. So the video was made by an American company called The Evidence Room, which specializes in creating videos for criminal matters. So they were hired by the Pistorius family and brought into Uncle Arnold Pistorius' house last year to make this quite extraordinary video of Pistorius on his stumps reenacting the shooting with his sister, Amy Pistorius, standing in as Reeva Steenkamp. This Australian TV broadcaster then got hold of it and broadcast it on Sunday as part of a wider special on the Pistorius trial. So once the footage was out there, all speculation, as you said this week, was that it would make its way into the trial. And it was unclear in what sense it would make it in, possibly with the defense arguing that it's broadcast had compromised Pistorius' right to a fair trial, and others saying that it was the state who would want to bring it up because the footage of Pistorius on his stumps possibly suggested that he had more extensive and more rapid mobility on his stumps than the defense had claimed, because you can see him in the footage sort of walk running along on his stumps and perhaps a little bit faster than you might have believed him capable of if you just listened to the defense, particularly Dr. Wayne Derman, after the past week. However, the video is actually inadmissible, and that is why it was, because it was produced for the court proceedings and then not shown, and that's why the state could not make mention of it. Legal analysts said, however, that when Kerry now had Wayne Derman back on the stand on Monday, he almost appeared to be trying to lure Wayne Derman into mentioning the video, because he was making references now to certain aspects which were definitely references to the video. He was saying, for instance, now, do you believe that Oscar Pistorius can run backwards on his stumps, which is something shown in the video? Do you believe that Oscar Pistorius can do X on his stumps, and again shown in the video? And it's possible that he was hoping Wayne Derman would say, it's obviously referring to this video. And then, as far as I understand it, if Derman had been baited into mentioning the video, then Nell could have said, m'lady, we need to bring in this video and show it. But that didn't happen. So as it is, it seems that the video has been, like many other aspects as we went along in this trial, nothing but a sideshow, really. And when BBC journalist Andrew Harding asked the defense yesterday, I think, why they had not, in the end, used the video as part of their evidence, the response was apparently that the reenactment was inaccurate. So from that perspective, it doesn't even seem to have any probative value anyway.
Rebecca, I've actually been wanting to ask you for a while. You've been following this case more than anyone else I know, pretty much. Every movement, every argument and counter-argument. Now, just for a moment, put yourself in the position of a judge. And what are your sort of leanings? Where do you think this is going?
It's very tough, and I must say, and I don't envy Judge Masipa at all. My personal feeling is that Oscar Pistorius' version remains improbable, but I do not feel that the state has necessarily done enough to prove that he killed Reva Steenkamp intentionally. Now, we know that motive, for instance, is not something that has to be proved in a South African criminal matter, only intention, but motive would certainly help towards the sort of plausible narrative of the evening. The state really has not managed to prove why Oscar Pistorius would kill Reva Steenkamp. There has been almost no evidence presented of an argument. In fact, the only hint of evidence there was one neighbor who said she thought she had heard a man and a woman's voices raised talking, but that evidence was called into question by the defense. That's it. The WhatsApp messages, I mean, the state was trying to make out that they presented a picture of a sort of strained, fractured relationship. Did they? I mean, there was a lot of evidence to the contrary as well presented in the course of the trial that Pistorius and Steenkamp had a loving, normal, healthy relationship. The psychologist and psychiatrist report came back to say definitively that Pistorius did not have a history of angry, violent outbursts towards women, that he didn't have psychopathic tendencies. So from that perspective, it seems to me that it's going to be quite hard for the judge to come down with a finding that Pistorius intended to kill Reva Steenkamp. The question of whether she can find that he intended to kill someone, however, is of course another question. And in that, I would say the state has been much more successful. So it doesn't seem to me it's likely that Pistorius will be acquitted, but it does seem that we're more likely to come down to a verdict of culpable homicide or murder, but not premeditated murder, than a finding that he unlawfully and intentionally killed Steenkamp.
Thanks, Rebecca. I guess you won't be lining up to take the Shreen Devani case as soon as that starts going. For your tainted soul to recover.
Well, now that I have my own law degree, Steely, it does seem a pity to waste it on you guys.
Rebecca Davis, thank you so much for joining us today on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Simon, your beat is Africa.
Yes.
What's going on? You've mentioned some stuff happening in Zambia you'd like to chat about today.
Yeah, Zambia's interesting. What's been happening? So basically 2 weeks ago, the president went missing. He was meant to be at home, but he wasn't at home. He wasn't making public appearances. No one was quite sure where he was. Then he suddenly turned up in Israel. And everyone was like, what on earth are you doing in Israel? So, of course, you know, the journalists being journalists, they went to ask people. So they went to his uncle, the president's uncle, who's also in the government, and said, look, where is the president? And he said, the president is having a holiday, a two-week holiday in Israel, as one does, without notice. Someone else went to the government communications person and said, where is the president? And the communications person said, no, the president is on an official state visit to Israel, without any publicity or warning. The Israeli media, meanwhile, went to the Israeli government and said, hey, why is the Zambian president in our country? There don't seem to be any, you know, public appearances or events. What's going on? And they said, oh, Is he here?
It's news to us.
He's certainly not here to meet with the government. In fact, the Israeli president, Shimon Peres, was in America for most of the time that Michael Sata, the Zambian president, was actually in Israel. So it has emerged that Michael Sata was in Israel seeking medical treatment. Now, African presidents have a track record of not being very open with their medical history. Robert Mugabe is, of course, a case in point in his mysterious visits to Singapore to treat something or other. No one's quite sure. He says they're shopping trips for his wife, Grace.
Visiting the Fountain of Youth.
Or visiting the Fountain of Youth. He does have remarkably good skin, I have to say. Whatever his skincare regime is, I want a bit of that action.
Yeah, and longevity as
yes.
Incredible.
Absolute power is the Fountain of Youth, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, he has apparently come back to Zambia. He was supposed to come back on Friday. I know someone, a head of a local NGO, who went to the airport because he wanted to see him come back for himself. So this guy, Chalufia Tail, he went to the airport at 8 p.m. and he waited there till after midnight. He saw no presidential planes land, only the normal scheduled commercial jets. And, of course, the president does not travel commercial. So he went home after midnight. The next day, the state media said, no, the president is back, and he got back at 10:05 on Friday night. So here we have an eyewitness saying, no presidential plane actually landed, I was there. And then we have state media saying something else completely. So we don't know where Michael Sata is. We don't know if he's healthy or if he's not. And it's all very concerning for Zambia, which so far has been a bit of an island of stability in Southern Africa. They've really done well. Their democracy is strong. The economy is growing. More and more companies are looking to invest there, particularly ones that used to be in Zimbabwe. They're now moving up to their northern neighbor. So it does raise a few concerns. It also raises concerns over who is going to succeed Michael Sata, because say he pops off, right? Which has happened in Zambia before. Levi Mwanawasa, I think it was in 2008 that he died suddenly, without much warning. It's happened in a number of other African countries as well. So let's say he dies, who succeeds him? Now, Zambia's vice president is a guy called Guy Scott, which you guys might remember.
South Africans, big fans.
Yes, right? Yes,
and
exactly.
Vice versa.
He was the guy that had a few home truths to tell us in decidedly undiplomatic language. I still think he's right, actually. I think South Africans have a bit of a problem with arrogance when it comes to the rest of the continent. Anyways, he's the vice president. However, his mother, I think, was not born in Zambia. And to be president, you have to have both parents born in Zambia. So he is not actually... The vice president is not eligible to take over the presidency. So when Michael Sata goes away, he has to nominate someone to act in his stead because the vice president cannot. So what happens if he suddenly dies in office? Who then takes over? There's certainly no public nominee, and constitutionally Guy Scott cannot do it. So it really leads to a very confused and potentially very worrying situation. It's a constitutional crisis, and what happens in these kinds of crises, these power vacuums, is that this is when conflicts emerge. Without a clear path, without a clear vision of where the country is going, it means people start competing. And when people compete, then they might fight. I don't think it's likely in Zambia, which is a very peaceful country, but it's certainly not good for the stability. It's not good for the country's economy. It's not good for the real development needs that it has and that it's trying to address. So all in all, not good news coming out of Zambia.
What do you think's happened to him?
I think he's sick. I think he's sick, and they are just trying to keep it as quiet as possible. I think that they think he'll be fine, and they're too scared of what's going to happen if he's not fine. So his party is desperately clinging on to him and keeping him alive as best they can.
Maybe we can lend them Mac Maharaj for a couple of weeks while they try and blow this over. I'd like to chat a little bit about Claudio Motsoeneng and some comments he's made recently about you, Simon.
I'd like to chat still, but I'm afraid I'm not a licensed journalist.
Right. Okay. your license being revoked.
Yes.
Right. Without swearing, what's your take on what Claudio has said and talking about regulating the media, when in essence, if any media organizations needed, a bit of propping up, I could think of one that has four letters and starts with S and ends with C.
Look, I'm going to leap to Laudy's defense here and say that there is a case in certain situations for some regulation of the media, Rwanda being a great example. There, the media was used to incite hatred, to incite violence, and that was one of the pivotal factors that turned an ethnic conflict in Rwanda into a genocide. Without the power of radio in particular, the Rwandan genocide could not have happened.
And also looking at what's happening in Uganda at the moment as well, and how the media is playing its role in prejudicing against the lesbian and gay community in Uganda.
Exactly. So media is an extraordinarily powerful tool. And if it's not used correctly, it can very much be used incorrectly. And so there are guidelines. You know, when we talk about media, we tend to talk about the likes of the Daily Maverick, the Mail and Guardian, the Star, etc. Established, reputable institutions, most of whom have signed up to, you know, various codes of conduct. They hold themselves to certain standards. We don't tend to talk about the likes of the, you know, random Rwandan genocide inciting radio stations, but those are media too. So when Claudi says that there is some call for regulation in some form or another, yes, you can see where he's coming from, but it's about context. Mm-hmm. And in South Africa, we have a strong, vibrant, thriving media that self-regulates. We do sign up to those codes of conduct. We do have principles, and we do have people in positions of power in our media who are committed to the truth and to getting the right stuff out there. So I do think that he doesn't really have a case to make in this particular country at this particular time. And of course, it's really concerning that this is what he's saying. And you do wonder, you know, is he going for the headlines? Is he trying to please his political masters?
Or more worryingly, is this following on from a trend that we've seen coming out of government, starting with Malusi Gigaba's comments at the election that they defeated the media, the marches on the Mail and Guardian and EWN subsequent to that? You know, is this part of a greater trend and a worrying trend for us, where we're seeing government and government institutions knives coming out for the independent media, especially?
It is. It's very worrying. But you know, it's a bit crazy because for me, the government is fighting a losing battle. If you look at us, you look at the Daily Maverick. We are an online site. Stilly, you'd know more about this than I do. But I mean, theoretically, we could publish our newspaper on some Icelandic server. It would still be available in South Africa. You know, there are ways around it. There are ways, even if the government were to regulate, you know, not traditional media, there are ways to get around those roadblocks, and we will find them because people do want to read unadulterated, uncensored content.
There's two ways where I think, you know, that could potentially go, and I always come back to the case of Thailand and my visit there last year when, you know, it became known to me for the first time that over 100,000 websites are banned by the government there. And not just those adult websites. These are anti-government, anti-monarchy websites that are the majority of whom are banned. And the only way that you can access them is by masking your IP address and using proxy servers to get to these sites. So there is a filtering and a censorship of the internet that can happen. But there are ways around that, and I don't think that's the way that our government would go. If it did want to take things further, where it does succeed is that it does influence media in an economic way by turning the economic screws rather than the direct screws of licensing and censorship, for example. Although, you know, with things like the secrecy bill, they are trying that as well. But the main effect, or the biggest effect that they can have, is by filtering and channeling advertising away from independent publishers like us, like the Mail and Guardian, you know, to more government-friendly organizations. And we've seen some of that happening already. We've seen other newspapers that are new and of age that are getting massive spends from government parastatals. And the government, through its own departments and through its parastatals, controls half of the ad spend in this country and half of almost every industry. So by doing that, there are other ways and more effective ways, because those ones are the ones that could actually bring you down a lot quicker and a lot faster than you know, censorship and licensing of journalists.
This is why we keep you around, Stilly. We journalists don't think of economic screws. We're all about the ideals. But you're absolutely right. That is where they're going to hurt us the most. As for the thing about, you know, government blocking websites. When I was in China last year, you know, China blocks all kinds of things. You know, Facebook, YouTube, the New York Times, etc., Twitter, and I needed to access Twitter for something. And I had no idea what to do. So, you know, there I was stuck in China, but I couldn't find a way around until I turned to the power of Google. I typed in free proxy server. I clicked on it, and it gave me a free proxy server. And it was as easy as that. It was a 20-second step before I was beyond China's firewall. So it governments may try to regulate that kind of thing. But they can't. The technology is always going to be very many steps ahead of them.
Yeah, definitely interesting times. You've been listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I've had Simon Allison in studio with me. We had Rebecca Davis on the line earlier talking Oscar Pistorius and Brooke Spector talking about the National Arts Festival. Tune in every Tuesday at 1 o'clock on cliffcentral.com, and Daily Maverick will be there with you.